Patrick Sullivan, Professor of Epidemiology at Emory University's Rollins School of Public Health, the co-director of the Prevention Sciences Core at Emory, the Emory Center for AIDS and Research, and a member of the U.S. Presidential Advisory Council on HIV/AIDS. Dr. Sullivan's career has included work on HIV surveillance at the CDC, HIV vaccine research at NIH-supported HIV Vaccine Trials Network, and research on HIV prevention for MSM supported by the NIH. Dr. Sullivan will be presenting on technology innovations in STD prevention and control.
Thank you. And somebody left a nice watch up here. So, yeah. So actually, this is a good time to say watches and my presentation time on a smartphone. And I actually had the great benefit and pleasure of being an EIS, starting my career as an EIS officer, but in the HIV prevention division. And more years ago than I care to say, but it got me thinking about that time in my life and when I had completed my first month of work, got a paycheck, and I took it to the bank and I deposited it. And I wonder if you think about when the last time you went into a bank was. And so what I want us to think about is, given Matt Golden laid out a really nice case about why we need to be doing more frequent routine screening for HIV, maybe with a different frequency, or for STIs, maybe with a different frequency for HIV. And I want to talk about technology and how we use new tools to try to practically implement the good science that we've already heard about. So I want to start by saying I started in HIV, but the longer I'm away from CDC, the more I think of these things jointly. So HIV and STI prevention stronger together. Why is this? In this season, we have to have... you have to take your shots. It's important because we're trying to serve the same populations with these programs. We have common interventions, common intervention providers, biological interactions, and important programmatic links between interventions and screening. And many of the technologies that I'm going to talk about, we've sort of piloted to a greater extent with HIV prevention and testing, but I think have easy connections to STI. So with respect to the biological relationships, in our cohort of white and black MSM called Involvement that we ran in Atlanta starting in 2010, shortly after we started, based on mounting evidence from research studies, we added screening for rectal STIs to our protocol. And we did self-administered rectal swabs. And when we started, we had long conversations about whether guys would be willing to self-administer rectal swabs in the context of a study visit. In the end, we looked back and had over 2,800 times when we asked men to do a self-administered rectal swab, and we had two refusals. I'm going to start by saying self-administered rectal swabs, in our experience in a research setting, was highly acceptable. And if you look at the incidence rates, so these are incidence rates in a prospective cohort, we see black-white disparities. But importantly, for rectal chlamydia, 11% per year, 6% per year for rectal gonorrhea, 9%. And about 4% per year in black and white MSM. So these are highly common incident STIs, many of which are asymptomatic. And this kind of work really takes a village. I'm not an STD clinician, so you guys will have awesome questions about some of these things, which I won't be able to answer, but I travel with good friends. And in this case, one of the innovations here was actually an epi innovation to think about what are the effects of rectal STI and HIV incidence. And the problem here from a methodologic point of view is we know that the same behaviors that can lead you to acquire a rectal STI can also lead you to acquire HIV. And so these two things get tangled up. So we can talk about it, just an unadjusted association that you're four times more likely to get HIV if you have also had a rectal STI. But by using propensity scoring and adjusting for this confounding, our colleagues Adam Vaughn and Colleen Kelly were actually able to get down to ascribing about 1 in 7 new HIV infections to rectal STIs. So were it not for rectal STIs, 1 in 7 HIV transmissions in men who have sex with men would not exist. So these are important programmatically. But it's really a question of scale. Multiple agent-based simulation models suggest that to get traction on HIV epidemics in men who have sex with men, using tools like PrEP and condom promotion, we need to get 30 to 50% coverage of multiple interventions. Sam Jeunesse had some great work published that estimated that we would need to get about 40% coverage of PrEP with 50% or higher adherence in order to prevent a quarter of new HIV transmissions in MSM. So how do we get these things to scale? If we're going to screen MSM for STIs every 3 months, how do we do that at scale in a group of young men who don't like to come into the doctor when they're not feeling badly? And so how are we doing with STIs? We know that asymptomatic rectal STIs are important contributors to HIV acquisition, but screening is limited. When we looked in our American Men's Internet Survey, which surveys 10 to 12,000 men per year, we just asked essentially the NHBS question about any STI screening in the previous year. And we found that among these largely sexually active men who have sex with men, that we're sort of falling generally below that 40% threshold for any screening of STIs in the prior year. And certainly screening for rectal STIs is less than this. So how do we get to scale? What are the strategies? One is to integrate service into medical care. And HIV really has pushed this with the idea of routine HIV screening in the setting of medical care. And for gay men, I think to the extent that men are having an annual routine medical visit, this is great to cover one test per year. But we need to think about how to get multiple testing opportunities per year into people's routine. And so I'm going to talk to you a bit about self-service screenings and referrals with an app that we've developed and tested called HealthMinder that really puts some reminders and some process of determining how often should I be screened into the hands of men. I brought up the issue of banks because I think thinking about healthcare as a transaction that happens in a physical setting, you know, in 20 years we may think of that as an analogy to banks. We used to go in every couple weeks and deposit our paycheck, and we're thinking about ways that we can actually have app-based, mail delivery-based, more virtual interactions with providers to increase frequency of these prevention activities, including STI screening. Another approach to increase the uptake of prevention services is to convert behavioral interventions into self-service formats online. Brian Mustansky in Chicago is leading a three-city trial of Keep It Up, which is a HIV and STI prevention intervention for young men who've just tested negative for HIV, and it's played out in six sessions, which are multi-format video interactive games, and the results of that will be coming out early next year. And finally, diversifying modes. So if we want people to test every 3 months for STIs, could one of those be in the doctor's office, one of those be a mail-out kit, and one of those be a drop-in location that's really an expedited service location so that we sort of mix up the options. So I just want to talk about a couple of these. These are screenshots of HealthMinder, which is a theoretically grounded intervention that we originally developed to promote routine HIV testing. And the idea of this is that men answer a series of questions and then get a recommendation about how often they should be screened for HIV and can then make a plan to test, say, three times a year. And they can choose how they want to do that, once at my doctor's office, once through an OraQuick kit, once in counseling and testing. And then on the far left panel, they can actually order an at-home test kit, order condoms and lube to be delivered to their home. And it's very much of a self-directed kind of making a prevention plan and implementing that. I just want to give you some teasing results here, which is our preliminary evaluation was with 121 MSM in Seattle and Atlanta. And 99 of those, we had complete data for at the end of 4 months. So we gave men the app. We let them use it without any other instruction. And at the end of that 4 months, 78% of those who had said at the beginning they were dissatisfied with their current condoms had actually ordered new condoms to try a different size or a bigger selection. 87% of the people who ordered condoms reported using them. Christine Kosrapor, who's a mutual colleague, did an analysis when she was at Emory to look at self-reported use of condoms that are distributed in venues, and that number is closer to 60%. If you've ever done condom distribution in venues, the discouraging thing is that about one in two of the packets you put in people's hand end up on the floor. And so we found that by letting men order and have these condoms delivered to their home, that we had a higher self-reported usage. Two-thirds of men who ordered HIV test kits said they weren't planning on being tested recently at the baseline, but when we offered them the option to order a home test kit, they took us up on that. At the beginning, about half of the users had a plan to test routinely for HIV, half did not. After 4 months of that half who did not, half of them had implemented a plan to test routinely for HIV, and 10% of our PrEP-eligible men started PrEP within 4 months of using the app. So I think this shows the ability in a fairly passive way to put out prevention resources and that men will consume them in a way that's self-directed. I want to mention at-home STI testing. So based on the model of self-specimen collection that Home Access developed for HIV, colleagues at Emory, including Aaron Siegler, who's here, have developed and supported the use of at-home STI collection kits. So these are mail-out kits with instructions. In our current implementation, we collect urine, rectal swabs, pharyngeal swabs, and a finger prick blood sample for syphilis testing. These specimens are mailed back in, and the tests that are indicated here are done. The results are returned in different ways in different service settings, but often negative results can be returned by email or text message. When we, in our cohort, when we ask guys for the syphilis and rectal STI and urethral STI testing that we were doing, how they preferred to get notified of results, 90% of them had a preference of either getting an email or a text message with their results. And when we have positive results, we always tell them, even if you said you'd like to get a text message, we will call you in certain circumstances if there's a problem with the specimen or the lab needs a retest or if there's a positive result. So those are delivered by phone. But most guys prefer to get these in the way they get lots of other important and sensitive information. In a couple research settings, our CIFAR has supported the implementation of mail-out test kits. And so the 1,000 Strong study that's being run by Christian Grove, of the 1,300 men who were sent an initial screening kit, 85% returned their STI specimens to the lab. In Brian Mustansky's Keep It Up 2.0, which is a cohort of young MSM, and if you have any young people living in your house, their follow-through on long-term tasks can be shaky. But in this cohort, 94% of those young men returned the specimen kit when it was mailed out for STI testing. I'm going to say a bit more about PrEP at Home, which is Aaron Siegler's work at Emory. So I think these at-home STI kits are acceptable to men. We get acceptable quality specimens, and we're able to provide these without visits to the a clinic. So PrEP at Home is a concept that Aaron Siegler of our group is developing with NIH support that basically says these interval monitoring, the every 3 months monitoring once someone is established on PrEP, creates a burden for healthcare systems for seeing basically well men to come back in for ongoing screening, and maybe a deterrent to guys staying on PrEP if they have to have routine and repeat visits. So Aaron's concept was to deliver a system that once men were stably on PrEP could be delivered to men at home and let them complete that interim monitoring without having to have a physical visit to the doctor's office. So after the standard PrEP initiation visit and follow-up at 1 and 3 months, for the subsequent 3 monthly visits, the participants receive a kit from our central lab. They use this to collect urine, rectal swabs, and a blood specimen. These are mailed in. The lab receives the kits and collates those results with results of a behavioral survey about adherence and risks that the participants take. These results are sent to the provider, and the provider can look at that and either decide, I'm happy renewing this prescription without any further interaction, or I want to have this patient come in for further testing, or I want to have telephone counseling, and that's the decision of the provider. So this video that I'm going to show you is actually the video that is shown to the participants about how to collect those specimens. The video is, I hope you'll think it's amusing. I mean, it's amusing in a public health way, but it's actually built on when we brought people in and asked them to use the materials, the mistakes that they made in those sessions we turned into points. So when you see the thing about pressing the dried blood spot down hard or not reading the instructions, those are based on problems that we observe. So this is a short video.
PrEP at Home is an easy way to stay healthy, self-screen, and do the right thing, all in the comfort of your own home. Here are a few things to look out for while completing your PrEP at Home kit. First of all, be sure to read the full instructions so you don't mess it up and have to do it all over again. Be sure to remove only one item at a time. Hey, stop monkeying around. After urinating in the cup, use the pipette to fill the tube up to the box. For the throat swab, look in the mirror. Looking good. DNA testing is sensitive, so a gentle caress on the sides of the throat will do. Time for the rectal swab. that wasn't so bad, was it? The blood samples can be a bit tricky, so... Hey, focus here. Read each step of the instructions carefully. It was a cute kitty. Now brace your finger and prick it with the device. Not as bad as you expected, right? Now you've got to milk that sucker until you see a drop. And bring it right to the tube.
It's the microtube for syphilis testing.
Keep it flowing. It's time for the specimen card. Now drop, don't blot, one drop in two of the circles. I said don't blot. Just one drop of blood per circle. No, wait. Let it dry for 4 hours before closing the card. Once dry, you can seal the bag, fill out the date, and pack up everything in the mailer. Next, complete the online survey. You've just continued on the path of a healthy life for you and your community. Thank you.
So what this turns into then is this report to the physician, which is sort of a green light, yellow light, red light. So this is a patient who did ORCQIC testing and reported that as negative, who didn't have symptoms of acute HIV in the survey, but did have a positive pharyngeal swab for gonorrhea. And so we'll make some recommendations, but the provider can do what they want with this, including just sign off to continue. So I just want to quickly say that in preliminary work with this, we work with both providers and patients to look at acceptability. And these bars at the top, basically the green bars for the providers and patients, represent the folks who are extremely interested. Providers are very interested in this, and patients are sort of interested. It's not the right solution for everybody. Aaron says that of the first 44 kits we sent out, there were two people of those 44 who said they just couldn't bring themselves to do the finger prick. And so those folks need to come in. But we don't have to have something that works for everybody. We want to talk about offsetting and providing options for those for whom this works. And I'll just pull out one of the quotes from a patient who said, I think it's useful, especially for SEI testing. Four of those 15 focus group patients said they were more likely to stay on PrEP if a home kit was available. So I just want to conclude by saying that for HIV and STI prevention, we share common at-risk populations and common tools, and the strategies that have been promising for HIV testing and prevention should be provided and evaluated for STI prevention. Mail-out kits are acceptable for MSM for self-collection of urethral, pharyngeal, and rectal swabs. Fingerstick blood specimens are acceptable, and the hands of our CIFAR laboratory have been suitable for an initial screen of syphilis by RPR. And we need to start taking these things out of research settings and into program settings and evaluate the extent to which they can be integrated with clinic-based programs in existing public health structures. I just want to acknowledge some of the many great collaborators who've worked on this, and especially Aaron Siegler, who's here, who's led our Prep at Home work. So I'll stop at that point for questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Sullivan, for a very interesting talk. I'm sure we have some questions people have for Dr. Sullivan. It's a great way how you, all the technology and the things, these innovations make things work much better for the system and for the people that we're trying to work with. So thank you.
Hi, Patrick. Sheena McCormack from London. That was great, really good. Just a couple of comments and a question. So I showed last night much higher rates of incidence for HIV in people who reported rectal infections, and that definitely bears out in the clinic. So I'm quite surprised your rates were so low, and I don't know if you wanted to comment on that. And then my other comment was about the level of coverage that you were saying you needed to get an impact, and I wonder if it really is that high. I mean, our models based on our data in the UK across the entire clinic network suggest that 80% of HIV is acquired from people with primary infection. And people on PrEP, that's the group you really get, the primary infection. So I just wondered if that's really a little bit too high.
Yeah, I mean, so I can, unfortunately, I was didn't see the full context of your rates last night, but so when in the cohort data that I showed, these were incidence rates over time. So there are two things. One is that it's not sort of a prevalence of people seeking testing, but these were repeat testing every 3 months over time. And it was in the context of regular HIV screening, prevention counseling every 3 months, and condom provision at those sort of research opportunity or visits. And so we may have been providing a pretty intensive level of risk reduction tools and counseling to those men. And then with respect to the modeling, I think the results, these models are great, but what they tell you is largely based on the knowledge you bring to them, mm-hmm. both in terms of inputs and assumptions. I'll say that there have been a series of models now, one developed by Steve Goudreau for our Lancet series in 2012, one developed by Ron Brookmeyer for South African MSM, and one developed by Sam Jeunesse that is parameterized to an Atlanta epidemic, that have taken slightly different approaches but reached this conclusion. And I think if you you can build into these are generally agent-based models that try to simulate the behaviors of men and the probabilities of encountering partners living with HIV and their infectiousness. And so I think talking some more about the data, and I think really from London particularly, there have been nice phylogenetic and sort of time clock data that suggests this clustering of transmission bursts. Mm-hmm. And I don't think the models really are built to function in that way. Mm-hmm. And so I guess it would be an opportunity for us to ask how the existing models can be adapted to more localized parameters and these different epidemic scenarios, and we might well get a different answer. So I think it has to do with our understanding of the epidemic, typologies and how we parameterize them, but happy to talk about feeding in more London-specific data to existing models.
I don't know that will help, because I think, like you, what we don't have is the data on the sexual networks and the connectivity, but they do seem to be clustered, and I think that's the big gain. My quick question was the proportion of your test kits that are returned.
The proportion of test kits that get returned, I have two answers for that. I may have more than two answers, but in a research setting where we actually can nudge people, this for the STI test kits has been 85 to 90 plus percent. For PrEP at home, it's quite high. When we've done a couple, some work, some with CDC and some where in our AMIS survey we just distributed for free home access kits. The home access kit return rate, which does require the DBS and mailing back in of specimens to home access, was lower. I think it was in the 40% range for those kits. And in the programmatic activity with CDC, again, where the test kit return is not incentivized, I think that was also more in the 50% range. And so I think it depends on how you incentivize these and whether we're getting kits to the most motivated people.
Sure. Thanks.
That's a great presentation, Patrick. I was wondering if you could comment on the HIV test used in the home test kit. Is it OraQuick, or are you running RNA tests on the blood spots? And also how you deal with RPRs, and are you able to quantify their RPRs in patients who have a history of syphilis?
Yeah, so these are good questions. Currently in this proof of concept, we're providing OraQuick kits, which I think is problematic in the way from the point of view of sensitivity with repeat screening. We have shown the collection of DBS specimens is very acceptable, and so I think it's just there's a resource question about whether we do that centralized in laboratories. But I think either of those are options, and I agree that an ultra-sensitive method would be preferred in a programmatic setting. And then from the perspective of syphilis, in the limited setting of the PrEP at home study where people have had a regular blood draw for an RPR at baseline and are known, their baseline titers are known, the decision of our laboratory and our infectious disease experts was that we take that specimen and we do an initial 1-4 RPR. And that 1-4 RPR, if negative, is taken as evidence of that 3-month visit of a lack of a robust response. If it's positive to any extent, then that gets referred back for subsequent testing. So for guys who have a longstanding infection that is sufficiently strong to light up an initial 1-4, they probably are going to need to have a physician or clinic-based setting to get that done. So this is really more for a limited purpose of monitoring new higher titer infections.
Patrick, thanks for your comments. The use of PrEP, of course, requires adherence. And you didn't mention the measurement of adherence. You've got the blood spots. Are you going to use those to monitor adherence, and are you going to report the results to the study subjects?
So I think there's just a question. We're collecting dried blood spots to show the feasibility of doing that as part of monitoring. I think this is just a question in our South African study where we are sort of following with South African colleagues, men on PrEP in clinics. We actually collect tenofovir diphosphate for a programmatic assessment of adherence, and then just collect specimens that are processed on more of a real-time basis for just tenofovir levels, the less expensive, you know, test. But I think it's variable the extent to which biological measures are used in programs and will be used. So we do a self-reported adherence measure as part of the survey, and in the study we're also collecting dried blood spots. I think we'll have to see where the field wants to go. If the field says we're going to actually do biological measures at one time a year or whatever, then that can just be integrated into the home monitoring kit. And I don't feel like we can set what the field is going to want to do, but I would say the research tools and the specimens are sufficient to support whatever decision clinicians make.
I had the sign that we're out of time. I want to thank all our speakers for a really interesting presentation showing how to have new approaches to old problems, and ask if you have other questions to please approach the speakers directly, if that's all right with you. Thanks very much.